After they had run out of food and fuel, the doors were closed and villagers had to fend for themselves. Collectivization was checkered with accidents, as we have seen in the last chapter. People were not only given contaminated products or tainted food, they also fell victim to poisoning accidents. In less than a month in 1960, some 134 fatal cases were reported to the Ministry of Hygiene, although this was a pale reflection of the reality on the ground. Pesticides were sometimes stored in canteens and granaries, while the tools used to prepare food or handle chemicals were not always kept apart. In Baudi County, Hebei, a roller contaminated with pesticides was used to mill the grain, and over 100 villagers were poisoned. Nothing was done. The flour was sold a few days later, and another 150 people fell ill. In Wenshui, Shaanxi, a pot used for poison found its way into the kitchen of a kindergarten, where more than 30 children ended up with severe intestinal pains. In Hubei, fertilizer balls were mistaken for bean cakes. 1,000 people fell ill, and 38 died. As food ran out, the government started promoting new food technologies and substitute foods. Most of these were quite harmless. The double steam method, heralded as a great revolution in cooking technology, enjoined cooks to steam the rice twice, adding water each time to bulk up the food. Some of the substitute foods consisted merely of ground corn cobs, corn stalks, or the chaff from soybeans and other grains. But the government also introduced new ersatz foods. Chlorella was heralded in the early 1950s by food experts around the world as a miracle form of algae that could convert 20 times more solar energy into protein than other plants. But the plankton soup that promised to pull millions out of hunger turned out to be impossible to produce and so vile to the palate that the craze eventually subsided. In China, the watery slime was elevated to the status of miracle food during the famine. It could be cultivated and skimmed from swampy ponds, but more often than not, it was grown in vats of human urine, the green stuff being scooped out, washed, and cooked with rice. It probably contributed very little in terms of nutrition. Scientists discovered in the 1960s that the nutrients were encased in tough cell walls that were impossible for human digestion to break down. Prisoners were used as guinea pigs. Besides the green plankton, which sickened the inmates, they were also fed sawdust and wood pulp. Bao Zhuowang, also known as Jean Pasqualini, the author of a memoir about life in a Chinese labor camp, remembered how brown sheets of the stuff were ground into paper pulp and mixed with flour. Mass constipation followed, killing the weaker prisoners. But even in the cities, the spread of substitute foods caused obstruction of the bowels or rupture of the sphincter. Workers at the Liang Ma factory in Beijing had to prise out their feces by hand. Villagers scoured the forest for plants, berries, and nuts. They combed the hills for edible roots and wild grasses. In desperation, they scavenged for carrion, rummaged through rubbish, scraped the bark off trees, and in the end turned to mud to fill their stomachs. Even in Beijing, foreigners witnessed people knocking off the leaves of acacia trees with sticks, which were then collected in bags and turned into soup. Yan Shifu, a wiry man with a broad grin, was a young boy aged 10 when the Great Leap Forward unfolded in Sichuan. He now works as a chef and has a good memory for food. He recalls how ramie leaves were finally chopped and turned into pancakes, rape stalks were cooked into a thick stew, while mustard leaves were boiled. Pea stalks were milled, sieved, and turned into small pancakes. Banana stalks were peeled and eaten raw, as if they were sugarcane. Radish was pickled and rare enough to be seen as a treat. Insects were popped live into the mouth, but worms and toads were grilled. Despite his family's ingenuity, his father and his younger sister died of starvation. Some of the grasses, mushrooms, and roots foraged by villagers were toxic. Few people actually knew what they were eating, as children were often the ones in charge of slipping out at night and foraging for wild herbs. In those days, one survivor reminisced, it was not possible to go out and look for known herbal remedies. We ate everything. We ate any plant that was green. We did not care. As long as we knew that the plant was not poisonous, we ate almost anything. But accidents were common. In Hebei, about 100 deaths caused by contaminated food, diseased animals, and toxic roots and herbs were reported each month. Cassava, a starchy tuber that could be milled into tapioca, is an excellent source of carbohydrates, but the leaves are highly toxic and cannot be eaten raw. In Guangxi province, some 174 people died in a single month after eating it without proper soaking and cooking. A similar number in Fujian province succumbed to a paralytic neurological disease caused by cassava, among thousands of cases of food poisoning. Cocklebur, a weedy plant, was another hazard. The seeds were highly toxic, killing unsupervised pigs rooting for food. In humans, it led to nausea and vomiting, as well as twisting of the neck muscles, followed by a rapid pulse, breathing difficulties, and eventually death. In 10 days, the toxic weed claimed 160 victims in Beijing. In a strange reversal of fortune, sometimes the most politically marginalized people were in a better position to survive, as they had developed coping mechanisms against starvation for many years before the Great Leap Forward. As the offspring of an evil landlord, Meng Xiaoli and his brother were chased from their ancestral house in Xianjiang, Hubei, immediately after the communist takeover in 1949. He was not given the time to gather any belongings. Though he was only a young boy, his jumper was torn from his back. They wandered about the village with their mother, ostracized by all, and ended up by the lakeside digging for wild vegetables. They slept on dried straw with the village dogs on their first night, and were later allocated a shabby mud hut. At first they tried to beg, but nobody dared to give them any food. "So we tried to catch fish from the lake, but couldn't catch enough to eat because we didn't have the right tools. But we still managed to survive because we could dig up lotus roots and pick up seeds. After a few months, my brother and I learned how to catch fish from the lake. Although we didn't have any rice, in fact, we could eat quite well." When the famine engulfed the village years later, the family was the only one to be prepared for survival. Straw and stalks were eaten from roofs. Zhao Jiabai, the orphan girl aged 11 who had to work like an adult to look after her little sister, remembered how one day, tortured by hunger, she climbed up a ladder onto the roof. "I was still quite young then. I was very hungry. So I broke a piece of maize stalk, used to cover the roof, and began to chew it. It tasted delicious. I chewed one piece after another. I was so hungry that even maize stalks tasted good." "Leather was softened and eaten," explained Zhu Erge, who witnessed half his village die of hunger in Sichuan, but managed to survive because his mother was a cook in the canteen. "We soaked the leather chairs people used to sit on. After they were soaked, we cooked the leather and cut it into small pieces to eat." Infected animals were eaten by the famished, even in the outskirts of the capital. In Huairou County, lambs contaminated with anthrax were regularly devoured by starved villagers. Hundreds were poisoned after eating bits of smelly fat mixed with clumps of hair scraped off animal hides by a Chengdu leather factory, which were bartered for vegetables with a people's canteen. Even the contaminated carcasses of diseased livestock culled by a slaughterhouse in Guangxian County were quietly sold to a local commune. When people were not eaten by rats, rats were eaten by people, dead ones sometimes being fished out of cesspits. When nothing else was left, people turned to a soft mud called Guanyin soil, named after the goddess of mercy. A work team sent by Li Qingxuan was taken aback by what they saw in Liangxian County, Sichuan. It was a vision of hell, as serried ranks of ghostly villagers queued up in front of deep pits, their shriveled bodies pouring with sweat under the glare of the sun, waiting for their turn to scramble down the hole and carve out a few handfuls of the porcelain white mud. Children, their ribs starting through the skin, fainted from exhaustion, their grimy bodies looking like mud sculptures shadowing the earth. Old women in ragged clothes burned paper charms and bowed, hands folded, mumbling strange incantations. A quarter of a million tons were dug out by more than 10,000 people. In one village alone, 214 families out of a total of 262 had eaten mud, several kilos per person. Some of the villagers filled their mouths with mud as they were digging in the pit, but most of them added water and kneaded the soil after mixing it with chaff, flowers and weeds, baking mud cakes that were filling, even if they provided little sustenance. Once eaten, the soil acted like cement, drying out the stomach and absorbing all the moisture inside the intestinal tract. Defecation became impossible. In every village, several people died a painful death, their colons blocked up with soil. In Henan, as He Guanhua recollected, so many people took to eating a local stone called Yanglishi, which was ground and turned into cakes, that adults would help each other prise out their feces with twigs. All over China, from Sichuan, Gansu, and Anhui to Henan, people tormented by ravening hunger turned to mud. People really did die of starvation. In contrast to many other famines where disease loomed large on the horizon of death. Starvation, in a strict clinical sense, means that the attrition of protein and fatty deposits in the body causes the muscles to waste away and eventually stop functioning, including the heart. Adults can survive for weeks without food, as long as they can drink water. The fat stored in the body provides the main source of energy and is broken down first. A small amount of calories are also stashed away in the liver as glycogen, which is generally converted within a day. But as soon as the fatty deposits have been exhausted, proteins are stripped from muscles and other tissues and used by the liver to produce sugars needed by the brain, the body's first priority. The brain quite literally starts cannibalizing the body, taking bits of this or that tissue to come up with the glucose it needs to survive. Blood pressure lowers, which means that the heart has to work harder. The body weakens and progressively becomes emaciated. As proteins are depleted, fluids start leaking out of the blood vessels and from disintegrating tissues, accumulating beneath the skin and in cavities around the body, producing oedema. The swelling first appears in the face, the feet and the legs, but fluids can also gravitate around the stomach and chest. Swollen knees make walking painful. Taking extra salt or watering down a meal to make it last longer only worsens the condition. But some of the starving do not suffer from edema and dehydrate instead. Their skin turning to parchment, shriveled and scaly, sometimes covered with brown spots. As the throat muscles weaken and the larynx dries up, the voice grows hoarse before falling silent. People tend to curl up to save energy. The lungs weaken. The face caves in. Cheekbones stand out, and bulging eyeballs are a gruesome white, staring vacantly and seemingly without emotion. The ribs poke through the skin, which hangs in folds. Arms and legs look like twigs. Black hair loses its color and falls out. The heart has to work harder still, as the volume of blood actually increases relative to a declining body weight. In the end, the organs are so damaged that they fail. Starvation may have been a taboo topic, but the archives are replete with reports about edema, Shuizhongbing, and death by starvation, Esi. Wu Ningkun, a professor of English literature, described what happened as he went through hunger. I was the first to come down with a serious case of oedema. I became emaciated, my ankles swelled, and my legs got so weak that I often fell while walking to the fields for forced labour. I did not know what I looked like, as there were no mirrors around, but I could tell from the ghastly looks of the other inmates that I must have been quite a sight. Few victims were as eloquent, but the symptoms were observed everywhere. In a commune in Tsinghuan, once considered Guangdong's granary, 40% of the villagers suffered from oedema in 1960. Even in cities it was common. We have already seen how half the workforce suffered from oedema in Beijing. Among high school students in Shanghai, oedema spread in 1960 to 61. In Nankai University, Tianjin's top institution of higher learning, one in five suffered from oedema. So common was the disease that when the famished did not develop it, an explanation was warranted. Yu Kaiming, an outspoken official appointed as the first secretary of Jiang Jiaku in 1959, observed how in the winter of 1960 to 61, starving villagers would suddenly drop dead as a consequence of low blood sugar without the usual signs of oedema. Why did villagers not succumb to epidemics in much greater numbers before terminal starvation set in? One reason, suggested above, is that the party closely monitored infectious diseases. But collectivization also brought about organizational chaos and the collapse of rural health care, which was rudimentary in the best of cases. A more plausible explanation is that people in the countryside starved to death much more quickly than elsewhere, reducing the window of opportunity during which germs could prey on a lowered immunity. The only available food was in the collective canteens, and access to these was controlled by local carders. Under immense pressure to come up with tangible results, many local officials used food as a weapon. As we shall see in the chapter on violence, villagers who did not work were not given any food, and those who could no longer work were often exhausted. Death followed promptly. Chapter 33. The Gulag. Xun Shaqing, a 54-year-old man working on a collective farm in Shanghai, made a fatal mistake on a summer's day in 1958. Rather than adding water to manure to reduce the solids, he poured the undiluted fertilizer directly over a row of carrots. The leaves wilted. Shun was obviously more interested in collecting work points than in selfless devotion to the great leap forward in agriculture. And he was brazen as well. Rather than show contrition after his arrest, he defiantly claimed that food was scarce and prison would at least provide him with bed and board. Closer scrutiny revealed that he had also slandered the party 2 years earlier. He was promptly packed off to a labor camp for 10 years in the windswept plains of Qinghai, 2,000 kilometers to the northwest of Shanghai. His file shows that he was released in September 1968, a sick and broken man willing to write the most demeaning confessions, from his deliberate act of sabotage 10 years earlier, to what appeared to be his biggest infraction during a decade of forced labor, namely the accidental breaking of government property in the form of a pane of glass. His sentence was severe, but many ordinary people faced a spell of 1 to 5 years in a camp for the slightest misdemeanor. Most of the evidence is securely locked away in the closed archives belonging to the public security bureaus, but reports on crime and punishment were occasionally copied to other party organs. For instance, a document detailing that even petty thieves in Nanjing were sentenced to terms ranging from 5 to 10 years in the summer of 1959. In Beijing, an internal prison registry with details of 400 male prisoners shows that a sentence of 5 to 10 years for a minor offence was nothing out of the ordinary. Deng Baojun, a farmer who had joined the People's Liberation Army in 1945, and was demobilized a decade later, pilfered two pairs of trousers worth a grand total of 17 yuan. He was jailed for 12 years on the 11th of February 1958. Chen Jiwen, an illiterate villager who stole from travelers at the Tianmen bus station in the capital, was given 15 years. Another pauper who eked out a living as a cowherd before making his way to the capital in 1957 was found thieving in front of the Beijing department store. He too was locked away for 15 years. But fewer people were shot than in the previous years, at least after 1958. The policy was to arrest fewer, kill fewer, and supervise fewer. Si Fuqi, Minister of Public Security, explained to his staff in April 1960. Death by execution, like everything else in the planned economy, was a figure, a target to be fulfilled, a table of statistics in which the numbers had to add up. 4,000 should be killed in 1960, he announced. This was lower than the previous year. In 1959, some 4,500 people were killed. The term was always kill, sha. The communist regimes rarely felt the need to disguise judicial killing with euphemisms such as death penalty or capital punishment. While 213,000 people were arrested and a further 677,000 were humiliated in public. None of these sensitive data are easy to come by, but a public security document from Hebei shows how this worked out at the provincial level. In the province surrounding the capital, some 16,000 counter-revolutionaries were arrested in 1958, three times more than in the preceding 2 years, as well as 20,000 common criminals, the highest figure since 1949, with the exception of 1955. These numbers dropped drastically in 1959, which saw the authorities apprehend 1,900 counter-revolutionaries and 5,000 common criminals. Little changed in 1960 and 1961, except that the number of common criminals went down to just over 1,000. About 800 were shot in 1959. Few may have been killed, but even a short stint in a labor camp could spell disease and death. A constellation of labor camps stretched across the country's most inhospitable regions, from the Great Northern Wilderness, as the vast swampy expanses of Heilongjiang were called, to the arid mountains and deserts of Qinghai and Gansu in the northwest. Life was miserable, if not tenuous, outside the Gulag system, but inside the salt and uranium mines, the brick factories, the state farms and labor camps, a brutal regime combined with widespread starvation to bury one out of every 4 or 5 inmates. In Huangshui, Sichuan, more than a third of all inmates starved to death. In Xiangbiangu, a sand dune area near the Gobi Desert in Gansu, the first batch of 2,300 prisoners arrived in December 1957. By the time the inmates were moved to another farm in September 1960, 1,000 had died in abject conditions. This was followed by a further 640 deaths in November and December, when the camp was finally closed down in the wake of Jiang Zhongliang's fall from power. Overall, in the entire province, some 82,000 prisoners worked in 100 reform through labor camps in June 1960. By December 1960, only 72,000 prisoners remained, close to 4,000 having died that month alone. The lowest annual death rates in labor camps recorded in the archives consulted for this book were 4 to 8% a year from 1959 to 1961 in Hebei, which held only a few thousand prisoners. How large was the population in the Laogai, or reform through labor camps? Si Fuqi put the total, excluding Tibet, at 1.8 million in 1960. Prisoners worked in 1,077 factories, mines and quarries, as well as on 440 farms. A rough death rate of 5% in 1958 and 1962, and 10% a year from 1959 to 1961, would amount to 700,000 deaths from disease and starvation. No wonder some wished to escape, but overall surveillance was tight, if only because the labor camps made a crucial contribution to the national economy, estimated by Si Fuqi in 1960 at 3 billion yuan per annum, not counting the 750,000 tons of produce from farms. Reform through labor camps were only one part of a much larger gulag system. People who were subjected to struggle sessions or put under formal surveillance, just under a million in 1959, were all too often dispatched to a local prison. And more importantly, from 1957 to 1962, formal justice was curtailed. This started, as always, at the top, in the person of Mao Zedong. In August 1958, he pronounced that every one of our party resolutions is a law. When we have a conference, it becomes the law. The great majority of rules and regulations, 90%, are drafted by the judicial administration. We should not rely on these. We should rely mainly on resolutions and conferences. Four conferences a year instead of common law and criminal law to keep order. The chairman's word was law indeed, as party committees, with the help of the masses, took charge of judicial matters. It was this political pressure that brought about the abolition of the Ministry of Justice in 1959. In the countryside, this meant that power shifted from the judicial authorities towards the local militias. In the entire county of Ningxin, Hebei, with a population of 830,000 people, a mere 80 cadres were in charge of the police, the inspectorate, and the courts. This was half as many as in the days prior to the advent of the People's Communes. The local militia relied on a whole new dimension added to the world of incarceration from August 1957, namely re-education through labor camps, called Liaoxiao. Common criminals like Shun Shanxing were handed a sentence by a people's tribunal, but prisoners in re-education camps were not subject to any judicial procedures and could be kept indefinitely until fully re-educated. In contrast to the reform through labor camps, they were organized not by the Ministry of Public Security, but by provinces, cities, counties, people's communes, and even villages. Anybody suspected of pilfering, vagrancy, slandering the party, daubing reactionary slogans on walls, obstructing labor, or committing an act regarded as against the spirit of the Great Leap Forward could be locked away in a re-education camp. These were just as harsh as the more formal labor camps, and they sprouted up everywhere after 1957. Si Fuqi mentioned 440,000 prisoners in re-education camps in 1960, but what he saw from the distance of his office in Beijing was no more than the tip of an iceberg. It was not until work teams were sent into the countryside from late 1960 onwards to supervise a purge of local cadres that the dimensions of local incarceration finally come to light. There was hardly a collective that did not run its own private gulag, backed up by the powerful militia created in the summer of 1958. Report after report mentioned how this or that unit, local police offices, village teams, people's communes, had established a private punishment camp, Sili Xingcheng. For every criminal like Shun Shanxing, formally handed over to the courts, several bypassed the judicial system and ended up in a local prison. The size of this shadow world will never be known. In the model commune of Su Shui, as we have seen, Zheng Guoqiong built an elaborate gulag system, extending from the county down to every brigade. It held 1.5% of the local population. In Fengxian, near Shanghai, villagers were routinely carried off to special labor camps, one of them set up specifically to lock up recalcitrant children. In Kaiping County, one brigade alone boasted no fewer than four camps, as hundreds of people were sent away for a couple of days or longer stretches of up to 150 days. Once inside the camps, many were beaten and tortured. Some were crippled